We're continuing a week of climate coverage here on The Takeaway as part of a collaboration with 250 other media organizations called Covering Climate Now. On Monday, we explored how climate change is causing anxiety for parents and kids and what they can do about it. But today, we take on a different piece of climate and mental health, a phenomenon called ecological grief. Some researchers define it as the grief felt in relation to experienced or anticipated ecological losses from environmental change.
I live in the bush. I live by a beautiful big river. My back door is the Wood Buffalo National Park.
That's Elder Francois Poulette, and he's a Dene Suliné member of the Smith's Landing Treaty 8 First Nation in Canada. He was speaking in Germany at the 2017 COP23, the UN's annual climate conference. For many Indigenous communities, climate change is taking its toll on the environment at a disproportionate rate. So for Elder Francois Poulette and many others living on the front lines of the climate crisis, the threat is real, it's present, and it's changing everything.
I live on the land. I also see the effects of global warming in my home. The water that comes by me is polluted. The air that we breathe up north is questionable. There is a changing life up there.
I have two people here to talk with me about ecological grief. Dr. Courtney Howard is an emergency physician, and she's the board president of the Canadian Association of Physicians for the Environment. Dr. Howard, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks, Danzina. Happy to be here.
And Kelton Miner is a PhD candidate in social and behavioral data science at the University of Copenhagen, and he's a research fellow at Crocs Fond Institute for Urban Economic Research. Kelton, welcome to The Takeaway.
So nice to be here.
So Dr. Howard, let's start with you. You've spent a decade living and working with Indigenous communities in the Arctic. How is life being changed by climate change?
Climate change is still not covered in most medical curricula, and it certainly wasn't covered 10 years ago when I first came to the high Arctic as a new doctor. And I happened to pick up a book on climate change on my way up, and I read it and got worried and started asking around. And it turned out that in Inuvik, where I was, it was already 3 degrees Celsius warmer than it was in the 1950s. So it's warming at about triple the global rate. And the people there still live a very traditional life. And so what they're finding is that 3 degrees makes a big difference when you're talking about the difference between solid water and liquid water, because they actually use the lakes and the rivers as highways to help them hunt in the wintertime and also to help them connect with their friends and family and cheaply transport building supplies into what would otherwise be flying communities. And so it's impacting their food security. It's impacting the safety of ice-based travel. They're finding that they're a little bit more disconnected because they can't go visit their friends in the neighboring village the way they used to. And you can imagine that when your world starts to look entirely different, it's disconcerting. So permafrost, when it melts, it actually destabilizes the entire slope and it looks like a landslide. And the trees, when their roots become less stable, they tip over. And so they're actually called drunken forests. You know, if you grew up in a place that didn't have those, and then, you know, throughout the course of your lifetime, all of a sudden there's landslides all over, the elders will tell you, you know, it looks entirely different than when I was little. And so the word we use for that is solastalgia. It means feeling homesick when you're still at home.
And tell us a little bit more about solastalgia. Like you said, it's feeling homesick when you're still at home, but how does it relate directly to this concept that we're seeing here? And why was there a need to come up with this new concept?
Well, I think we didn't have words for that feeling of sadness. And what we found last year in Canada is, and we did a case study in ecological grief and eco-anxiety, what has been shown is that it's the people who live closest to the land who notice the changes in the land first. I don't depend on the land nearby for my livelihood, so I'm less likely to be paying super close attention. But it actually not only is a threat to just the way the landscape looks, but it's also a threat to their culture and their way of life.
I want to talk a little bit more, Dr. Howard, in a bit about the diagnostic definition for ecological grief, if there is one. But just for a minute, let me bring in Kelton, because you recently spent some time in Greenland trying to put some data to these feelings that people were having. Tell us a little bit about your research, Kelton.
Sure. You know, when most people think about Greenland with regards to climate change, many think about its melting ice sheet and the projected perils of sea level rise, and perhaps understandably so. In the month of July alone, 197 billion tons of ice from the Greenland ice sheet melted into the ocean. According to the most recent IPCC report, the Arctic is currently warming 2 to 3 times faster, as Courtney touched on, than the rest of the world. But less attention has been paid to what residents living in Greenland's coastal towns and settlements around the ice sheet actually think about recent and ongoing environmental changes across Greenland. So this past year, I had the opportunity to help lead a research team from the University of Greenland and the University of Copenhagen to conduct the first sort of national representative survey. About 2% of all adults in Greenland took the survey from all around Greenland. And since Greenland largely lacks connecting highways and roads between locations, our research teams traveled to reach residents using a combination of small plane, helicopter, and boat, really any means necessary to actually give their voice an opportunity to be heard.
What did the numbers tell us, Kelton?
Yeah, so compared to the U.S., where a recent national survey by Yale and George Mason universities found that about 7 in 10 people think global warming is happening, we found that in Greenland far more, about 9 in 10 residents think climate change is happening, compared just to 1% who do not. On an individual level, we found that a large majority, over 3 in 4 residents in Greenland, say that they have personally experienced the effects of climate change, suggesting that the effects of climate change are pervasive and widely perceived by the Greenlandic population.
Dr. Howard, we've talked about ecological grief. Is that a diagnosis? And if so, how do you alleviate some of these feelings?
So this is really an emerging area, and it makes sense that it almost feels as though the public conversation is almost leading the clinical conversation, because things are changing so quickly and medical curricula historically changes really slowly. So the medical students are trying really hard to get this into curricula, but mental health is always neglected, whether it's in curricula or in research. So the American Psychological Association has a paper that they put out a couple of years ago called Mental Health and Our Changing Climate that talks about this, but it's certainly not yet in, you know, the DSM-5, which is the thing that we use to issue diagnoses. But what I think is really useful about us talking about this is that when I give presentations, I still often have people coming up to me at the end of a presentation with tears in their eyes saying, you know, I thought I was the only person who was this worried about climate change. Now I know I'm not the only one. And so I think it's really helpful for us to be talking about this, because it makes people realize that it's normal to be worried about this change in our planet and what it means for our health and our kids' health. And that is the start of bringing us into conversation. And the great part about that is that's the start of looking for solutions.
Dr. Howard, we've been focusing on indigenous populations here, since many are closest to the most visible effects of climate change. But I'm wondering if any of what they're experiencing also extends to others. Can we learn from it?
I think we're all living in an environment that's changing, and it's just that it was easiest to pick up first in the place that was changing the fastest. But now that we're seeing heat waves, you know, sending people to hospital, and big clouds of smoke coming from wildfires and communities being devastated, you know, we're all on this planet together. And I think it makes sense that we're feeling this way now. And so what I think is important is that talking about it does start to make people feel better immediately. And when we start to create solutions together, the psychological literature, again, it's emerging, shows that we start to feel better about it. So action feels better than anxiety. So, you know, here in Yellowknife, after our bad wildfire summer, we got together as neighbors and we said, hey, let's make some clean energy, you know, let's do something about this. And we had a bunch of potlucks, and we ended up doing a big bulk buy for solar panels. So there was new bling in the neighborhood, and we had new friends. And that's the kind of thing that built that web of resilience, where if there ever was an emergency in the neighborhood, now I know who the elderly person is down the block who might need some help. And meanwhile, we're starting to speed along the low carbon transition that we know we need to do in order to keep ourselves safe. So a psychiatrist here in Canada, Greg Dubord, has told me before, you know, I wouldn't medicate this. I would prescribe climate action, because the world's sending up danger signals to us, and humans have survived this long by heeding those danger signals and taking action. You know, if you put your head out of a tent and there's a bear there, you're going to go, ah, you're going to have a moment of acute anxiety, and then you're going to run away from the bear. That's our chance now, is to go, oh my goodness, we're seeing the changes. It doesn't feel good. Scientists are telling us it's going to get worse. Let's get together, talk about how we feel, and make a plan. I think many of us are now at the point where we're trying to align the way we live our lives with the way it is now apparent we need to live them. And that's a process and nobody's perfect, but I think we're starting to make some real changes and we can feel good about that.
Kelton, do people in Greenland have a sense of how they're going to cope with climate change as the Arctic warms even more?
Certainly. I mean, what's very apparent in Greenland is that whether you ask people about their perceptions of recent sea ice changes or recent changes in nearby glaciers or just their thoughts about climate change in general, we find that people are much more likely to feel negative sentiment about those changes, those recent changes. And this raises some interesting questions, like how, you know, might they cope with both those feelings and anxieties, but also very practical and real changes that they experience around them. We found that actually 8 in 10 residents think that the sea ice has become more dangerous to travel on in recent years. So just to put that perspective, about a quarter of the population in Greenland went on the sea ice at least once in the past year. And the sea ice is sort of this connective tissue, especially in north and northwestern Greenland and eastern Greenland, that links all of these communities and livelihoods and resources together, allows people to do activities that they've conducted for a long time and that have been passed down from generation to generation. We found that actually over 3/4 of the population get at least some of their diet from local foods that they hunt, fish, or gather. And when we asked people about whether they thought climate change would harm or benefit fishing and hunting in the future, we actually found that far more residents think that climate change will harm those sort of core industries and parts of the really cultural ancestry and identity of Greenland than would benefit them. But interestingly, we also found that 1/3 of the population, or over 1/3, think that climate change will actually benefit shipping, agriculture, as well as mining and tourism. And I think this suggests that as people are adapting to these changes, there is a simultaneous sort of chain of events of both adapting existing ways of life and also trying to make the most of these emergent opportunities to really not only survive, but also to thrive.
And Dr. Howard, just to round out the conversation here, I mean, we mentioned treatment would not be medical per se or medication per se, but climate activism. But beyond that, I mean, what are the implications of this? You know, as I mentioned earlier, we're seeing growing anxiety among young people about climate change in the world as it is starting to unfold before them. What kinds of effects will these symptoms of ecological grief have collectively as climate change gets worse?
When a patient comes into the emergency department, and we have a high burden of mental health up here in the north, and so I see a lot of patients with mental health issues, you know, your first job is to make sure they're safe. So are they a danger to themselves? Are they a danger to their community? Are they functioning? And so, you know, if people are feeling really worried about the climate, I have spoken with people who've fallen into deep depression and become suicidal. So it's important that if people are not safe, that they go see a physician. Number two, you know, really talking about it, being isolated with these feelings is really the worst. It's a second type of suffering that we don't need to have. And so coming into community to start to discuss with one another, talk about those feelings and come up with solutions really is, I think, going to be the cornerstone of this, because action definitely feels better than anxiety. And meanwhile, you know, I think it's really important that we start to develop some insight into how these feelings are impacting our judgment as you're trying to figure out how to help somebody. You ask yourself, okay, do they know how they're feeling? And do they know, is that impacting what they do? Because it makes me wonder if that sort of bad feeling that climate change gives us is making us avoid it and avoid tackling it. Whereas if we talk about how it's making us feel more, maybe we'll come to a more centered understanding and a centered place emotionally that will help us in terms of our judgment and our actions. So I think we have a lot of discussion to do as a society. And overall, even I know how painful it is to be feeling this way for so many people, I think it may actually be the start of some of our most productive coping.
Kelton, what lessons should people outside of the Arctic take away from your findings?
I think one of the key findings is that even though we often think about climate change and talk about global warming on the global level, it's really important to realize that many of these Arctic communities and really some of the communities that are most susceptible to these ongoing changes are often removed from view. And it's really important to realize that, you know, these places are warming faster than the rest of the world. So even though they're disproportionately affected by climate change, they are also some of the communities least responsible for these changes. So there is an element of environmental justice that should be taken into account. And I also think, you know, importantly, that we can learn from the ingenuity and clever creativity of communities in the Arctic that are already adapting to climate change in ingenious ways.
Kelton Miner is a PhD candidate in social and behavioral data science at the University of Copenhagen, and he's a research fellow at Kraks Fond Institute for Urban Economic Research. And Dr. Courtney Howard is the board president of the Canadian Association of Physicians for the Environment. Thanks to you both.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for covering this.
Thanks so much.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.